This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears and I'm joined by Bradley Chambers. And this episode of Out of School is sponsored by DisplayNote. More about them as the show goes on, or visit them at displaynote.com. How are you doing, Bradley?
It's been a good week. It's been a busy Tuesday. My wife and I are trying to sell our home and the realtor contract has expired. So I don't know if it's this way in Scotland, but what happens when your realtor contract expires is you get a rush of realtors trying to get you to relist with them. And so we've had a lot of letters and a lot of emails and then a lot of drop-in visits. And so I jokingly had a tweet on Sunday. In the U.S., we have a do not call registry where you can put your phone number and solicitors cannot call you. I said there should be a do not visit my house for any reason unannounced list. If they visit,
I think that's called a dog.
Yeah, well, we have two of them. They're just too small and to scare anybody away. And so I had a guy come by, I guess it was Sunday, during my son's nap time and start knocking on the door. And so not that any of our listeners care about this, but that's kind of my world. And so a lot of fun.
Yeah, well, my world has been all hospitals and medical stuff this week. As folk who follow me on Twitter know, I tore the cartilage in my knee about 6 weeks ago and then re-injured it again a week and a bit ago. Had surgery and have pretty much been sitting on the sofa ever since. I've got crutches and a walking frame and all kinds of things in the house. And it's another 5 weeks till I can put my foot down. So anything that involves sitting at a desk is just golden for me right now.
So I guess lots of Kindle reading and lots of tweeting.
I've been through several Kindle books, yeah, and quite a few iTunes rentals, and I just got back to my desk the past couple of days because sitting up in an office chair was difficult for the first few days. So we're getting better, but it's going to be a long road back to 100%.
How are things at school holding up?
Okay, you know, it's funny that this should happen just after our episode about iTunes U, because one of the things I have been doing from the sofa is basically building lessons for my class and posting them through iTunes U. And I presume those kids are getting on okay back at school because I haven't been back at school this week. In total, I've had maybe 5 or 6 teaching days off over this. But the feedback I've heard so far is that it's been pretty good. I've mostly been using just posting lessons in iTunes U and using the Explain Everything app, which basically lets me do a voiceover whiteboard lesson, which I can then export to video and post into iTunes U for the kids to watch and review. And it's not as good as face-to-face teaching, but it is filling a gap in a bit of an emergency situation for us. So, you know, so far so good with iTunes U as well.
You know, one of the things that when I was in college they were discussing was a disaster recovery plan. Like if there was, you know, terrible weather for weeks on end, or if there was an emergency, like do we have any sort of disaster recovery plan? And really in a situation, you know, if you guys had to close school for days on end, iTunes U is a pretty decent disaster recovery platform.
Yeah. I mean, even a couple of seasons ago, we had 2 winters which were very heavily snowed in, which is not common in Greenock, but we had 2 winters in a row where we lost a week of school each to snow. And in both of those cases, because most of our kids had their iPads at home, we were able to keep a semblance of school going by, and that time we were using just email, but sending home things by email and having communication between parents and students on email. So that was a very early good result from our iPad program. And iTunes U just kind of takes that to the next level and makes it a whole lot more structured.
That's true. It was interesting when I was watching the Amazon announcements and looking at the Kindle Fire HD, and it looks like a great device from a consumption standpoint. Again, I've not played with one, but in terms of education, things like iTunes U and the volume purchase program and Apple Configurator, those take the iPad to the next level in terms of deployments and usability in our worlds. And really, the Kindle has nothing with that. And I think that just goes to show that iTunes U, while again, doesn't cost money, if it keeps schools looking at iOS as a platform, it's indirectly making Apple a lot of money.
Well, it's interesting you talk about Kindle because the topic of today's show is ebooks in schools. And obviously, the Kindle Fire just coming out this week, you're right, it looks like a very attractive device, although we'll put a link in the show notes to a very sort of early hands-on YouTube video that I watched recently, which showed that the device sort of still suffers from quite a lot of lag. And this was the Kindle Fire 7-inch HD, so that the upgraded specification and so on. So I think that the Kindle's an interesting device. The hardware Kindle and then the Kindle Fire is also quite interesting. But those, even just like the iPad was, and to a large extent still is, they still feel like very personal devices. So it would be interesting to see. I'd like to know if there are schools who are kind of going heavily down the Kindle route. I don't know if you've heard of any.
Well, we have a school, and it's actually a school I was going to reference here later on in the show. It's a private middle school and high school in our town, that they actually have a handful of Kindles in their library. And then we've actually got a teacher that parents have donated e-ink Kindles to her, mm-hmm. for her classroom. And of course, the issue is there's just no platform for a school to manage those easily. Basically, you manage them through your Amazon.com account, and you can have up to, I believe, 6 Kindles on an account. And so basically, she asked for, over the course of 2 years, asked for her parents to donate Kindles. In the U.S., you can collect box tops off of things you buy at the grocery store, and you redeem those for eventually get certificates. And so she bought Kindles, and she loves them in her classroom. She has a reading station, and again, this other school is using them in their library. But the crux of it is there's no management system for schools. So to me, it's until they make it where they have a platform for you to convert an entire school or your entire library to Kindle, it'll largely be a consumer device that we kind of shoehorn in to various deployments. Again, and it's great for a classroom here, a classroom there, but there's no way for me to manage a school full of electronic ink Kindles or even the Kindle Fire. It's not possible.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, this is becoming a bit of a refrain of this podcast, is management systems on top of consumer products. I think this is a tricky one, though, because for many, not many years, but for at least a couple of years, I've kind of been saying, look, just embrace consumerization. But one of the problems that I've sort of run into as we've gone through this is that the question of the consumerization problem is not just, can you get one for everybody? But the question is, who pays for content? And that's really the hard part, I think, in embracing that consumerized approach. Because unless everybody's looking at free books and everybody's downloading free apps and so on, then even if you solve the problem of who purchases the equipment, and if you get one-to-one, the next question is, well, who pays for the ongoing access to Evernote Premium, Dropbox for Teams, App Store, electronic books, and so on? And I think actually with, you know, Configurator and the volume purchase programs, the first step to somebody somewhere solving the problem of not just how do you deploy, but how do you on an ongoing basis sort of digitize your commercial resources such that you can deploy them on these devices. Well, I think that's really the heart of what we're talking about today.
Well, and we have parents who ask us that often. They say, you know, they'll have a kid that's 85 pounds and they'll have a backpack that weighs 60. And so they'll ask us, why don't you guys just get all electronic books? And it's a loaded question. And again, you've got the promise of the electronic books is great. And it's not a matter ultimately of the technology or the vision. It's really just a matter of the bureaucracy in some ways of the book vendors, that we don't have a central way. And I think that, to me, this is the crux of the issue. There's not a way for me on a school-wide level to get the right books onto the right devices in a way that we can manage them, afford to pay for them, but also get them back at the end of the year.
Yeah, we've had various visits from publishers over the past couple of years of our iPad deployment, and some of the early conversations were hilarious, you know, because I'll give you one example. We had a publisher come to us and they sold a set of a reading scheme, you know, a 2 shelves full of books, and kids would progress from one book to the next and so on. And what they were doing was they had basically taken a PDF version of the book, wrapped it up in an app, and they were selling the app for the same price as the book. which was, I think, £6, you know. But if you buy a paper book for £6, that book lasts 12 years, let's say, then you're paying 50 pence a year for the book. But the problem, you know, if I bought those apps, then I, and in principle, I'm buying a £6 app per pupil, and then they just move through all of these different apps, because the problem was they had wrapped one book in one app and were selling for the same price. So they hadn't really thought about the kind of the overall cost structure of the problem. And I think maybe this is the first thing we want to get into, is talking about cost, because that's really what underlies a lot of the questions about why don't you guys just go for electronic books. Is, well, one, we can't afford it, because what the price that people want for electronic books and the way that we use paper books are just wildly different things. Does that make sense?
Well, yeah, exactly. Now, and because there are two models for, I know here in our city, you have various different ways schools do books. You have the student bought or the school bought. And so we buy all of the books for our students and then basically rent them, I guess, with their tuition. I guess renting is the word. And then at some of the middle school and high schools in our city, the students actually, again, this is private, not public, the students actually are required to buy their own books. And so it's a largely an easier problem to solve when the students are buying their books. But again, when it's me that's having to come up with the resources to buy a book that in some ways is just as expensive as the paper book, but at least with the paper book, I can reuse that book year after year after year. With the way the licensing works right now, there's really just no easy way to do that.
Yeah, and I think the thing is that quite often people talk about electronic books in schools as if there's one kind of book in a school. And I think there, as far as I can tell, there's really three distinct kinds of book that are used in schools. We have the reading book in early years education, which is typically a very short book, obviously very simple for beginning readers. But the way that those books are used is that one child will potentially take a book home for two nights. They'll read that book and then they'll go on to the next one and the next one and the next one. And there may be 60 to 100 books in the set, and a pupil will progress through all of those on their path to becoming a reader. Now, those books are in themselves quite expensive. You might pay £5 per book, but those books will be rapidly reused, you know, on a almost daily or two daily basis to different pupils at different times. So a very rapid check-in and check-out model there. The next kind of book, as far as I can tell, that you have is the textbook. And the textbook is typically assigned to one student for most of, or all of an academic year, and then retained by the school and then given to the next pupil and so on. And I know in the States, I mean, you can correct me if I'm wrong here, but my understanding is that textbooks are just unimaginably expensive in America. For some reason, they're like $200, right?
It depends on the book. Of course, in higher education, they drastically can get more expensive. I asked my headmaster, I said, what does an average book, like a math book, cost us? And he said $90. Again, we might use that for many years. And so if you break it down in cost per year, it's very inexpensive. And it's just the way it's set up now, I would have to buy that same book digitally every single year because I would lose a license to it if, say, I went through the iBookstore for that book.
Yeah. For comparison purposes, in the UK, I reckon a senior level textbook in high school would maybe cost between £13 and £18.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think one of the things about textbooks on devices is that a lot of companies have focused themselves on solving the American problem, which is the very expensive textbook. And that's not worldwide. That's not the same problem that it is in the US, because companies like Inkling, for example, which some people might have heard of, their first attack on textbooks on iOS was to basically try and sell you chapter by chapter a book, so you could buy a chapter for like $3 and then buy the next chapter for $3 and so on. So they would spread the cost of the book and you could maybe not buy the chapters that weren't directly relevant to what it was you were studying. But that was solving a very specifically American problem, I think. And worldwide, I think the bigger problem actually for textbooks is just getting the publishers to produce them. Yeah. Because I've seen, you know, with our new curriculum in Scotland, I've seen new textbooks come out and they're only on paper. And I'm looking at Terry Maher going, what year is this? Why are you only producing these things on paper? But I guess the true answer to that is that because there aren't enough computers in schools for people to buy digital ones.
Well, and another problem we have here in the U.S. is, I may have mentioned this on a prior show, the book industry is largely controlled by the state of Texas and the state of California because they buy their books at the statewide level. And so, for example, if the book starts leaning too much of a conservative way, well, the California buyers get upset. It's because it's largely known as a more liberal state. And vice versa, if the book starts leaning more liberal, the folks in Texas get upset because, again, they're buying their books on the public side at the statewide level. Mm-hmm. And so it's just a lot of bureaucracy because we are largely using a lot of the same books that the public schools use as well. And it feels like it's a lot of way like the TV industry, where it's not that you don't have an ideal situation on what you would like to see. It's just that there's no incentive for the television content producers or the book publishers to do it, because what's the alternative? We have to buy that. We have to buy books.
Yeah. Although it's a very difficult one. I mean, I think in some ways, a textbook is a minimum guarantee of competency across education. You know, it's not that giving every teacher a textbook guarantees every teacher will be amazing, but what it does guarantee is that they will at least have a sort of safety net, if you like, where if everything else goes disastrously wrong with this teacher, the kids will at least be able to look at the textbook and have a good chance of learning something from it, you know? So it's a tricky one. The textbook one's a tricky one. The third kind of book that I wanted to mention was the novel, the class novel, if you like. And in some ways, this is the easiest one to deploy right now, even if it's not easy to deploy it perfectly legally. You can at least get access to these books. You know, so I'm talking about books like Lord of the Flies and To Kill a Mockingbird and the classics that people study in English literature classes all over the world. A lot of those books are freely available through multiple channels electronically now, and they're pretty straightforward to deploy. We've done a few of them at school, and I'm not, again, this is kind of the same disclaimer as I gave in the volume purchase episode that we talked about, but it's actually even harder to deploy a book legally than it is to deploy an app legally. Because with apps, you at least notionally have gifting, which if you could get through all the rate limiters, you could purchase 20, 30, 40 copies of an app. But at least in the UK, and I'm pretty sure in the US as well, the iBook store doesn't support gifting a book in any form at all. And I know that the Kindle store in the UK doesn't support gifting Kindle titles either, although I believe that is available in the US.
It is.
So there's some tricky rules around gifting books as well. But we have certainly bought a couple of books because of our common Apple ID system. We've tried it, bought a couple of novels and put them, synced them onto several iPads to see how that went. And I think in general, the feedback was pretty positive, both from the children and from the teachers, that they quite liked reading with electronic books.
Well, yeah, I think especially if you've got a classroom full, like we've got a fifth grade classroom, and they read the same books generally year after year, and they start getting worn. And so really now is the time you'd like to say, let's move these to digital. Let's stop that problem. Let's not have books that have been highlighted. Again, it's so frustrating from my perspective because parents know what they want. Teachers know what they want. I know what I want. And it's just not there. It's not an issue of we can't, you know, we need a better management system for electronic books. And right now it's like, well, like in our situation, some of our books are available digitally. Some of them are available through the Inklings app. Some of them are available directly as like a PDF from the publisher. So there's not like one central place that I can get them. And from a deployment and from a scalability side, I've got to have more simplicity to be able to get the right books on the right devices.
Yeah, I mean, you either have to have more simplicity or a management console, or you just need the books to be cheaper. You know, we need to have a storefront where the books can be 20 pence each, but we will guarantee to buy 400 copies over 4 years.
Right. Instead of using the, you know, we kind of maybe come out the same in the end cost wise. And I'm okay with that because I'm not necessarily looking for cheaper textbooks, although that's ideal. I'm not asking for textbook costs to go down to 99 cents or $5 for a textbook. That would be great. But I just want a better way to get them on the devices so I can hand a student an iPad preloaded with either all of his or her books and iBooks, or just having each book be an app, just something where they're not carrying around backpacks full of textbooks that weigh as much as they do.
Yeah, I think of all the things that have sort of disappointed me with our iPad program is that we haven't got the weight of the backpack down the way that people imagine that we have. I still see kids carrying pretty substantial bags full of paper, folders, notes, and their iPad as well. It's certainly not as much. I mean, I know in my class particularly, the amount of paper that is going around has gone down to pretty close to zero. And I think we're going to start to see more of a transition to that as iTunes U sort of becomes more embedded in the school. But I know for now, a lot of teachers still feel comforted in giving out a textbook. And also, we're still in that transition period where there are going to be new exams and we don't know what the shape of the textbook is for those new exams.
Well, I think now would be a great time to talk about our sponsor for today. We are excited to have Display Note back as a sponsor of Out of School this week. We greatly appreciate them sponsoring the show. Display Note is a brand new application that lets teachers take everything they do on their Windows or Mac computer and stream that out to connected devices like an iPad, an Android device, or a laptop. So the scenario you can imagine is instead of having to print out a keynote or a PowerPoint with all the notes on there, you can actually blast that out to all the students' devices. And then they can actually add their own notes and media and annotations, and then they can save it and store everything. So going back to that cutting down on paper, Display Note would be a perfect application for that. When you're in collaboration mode, multiple devices can work on the same content together. And then when you're in presenter mode, Display Note allows your tablet or your smartphone to be used as a wireless presenter tablet and lets you send private messages to other connected devices and allows you to view other people's screens. Classroom license is only $695, and that's a one-time fee, and that allows up to 40 connections. Faculty and site and district licenses are available on request. Again, we appreciate Display Note sponsoring the show this week, and you can find out more about them at displaynote.com, and there will be a link in the show notes.
All right. I think we should talk about what the other side of electronic books in the classroom, which I think is quite interesting, is. And this is the idea of making books in the classroom as opposed to just reading commercial books in the classroom. I don't know if you've had any experience of doing any of this in your school.
We have not, so I'm interested to hear about that.
All right. Well, the history of making e-books in the Apple world has been a bit kind of – it was a bit slow to get going. Let's put it that way. I mean, obviously, iBooks came out the same day as the iPad. So Apple's always had an EPUB reader that was pretty good. I mean, I really like iBooks personally. I think it's nicer than the Kindle application, but I like the Kindle range a little better, so I buy most of my books through the Kindle. But Apple didn't really have an EPUB creation tool that was very good. And eventually, I think it was maybe 6 or 8 months after the iPad came out, they put EPUB export features into Pages. And we experimented with that a little bit and found it to be just unbearably fiddly. It was basically what you had to do was there was a template Pages document on apple.com that you could download. And it used the Pages style system to identify certain parts of the book, certain parts of the EPUB structure by the style that was applied to the text in the book. So, for example, paragraph one, the use of paragraph one would indicate a chapter heading and a section break would indicate the end of the chapter and so on. So there was a very complex mapping between features in Pages and features of the EPUB export structure. And what you had to do to write your book was you would type it in Pages, apply all these styles, and then export it as an EPUB. Somehow get that EPUB onto your iPad, then open it in iBooks. And this was a very slow process. And it was doubly painful because there was no preview on the Mac. Because as you know, there's no iBooks application on the Mac. There's no really good EPUB reader on the Mac. I guess maybe the best one people use is Calibre. But it's still not the same rendering as you see on the iPad. So you had to maybe put the file in your Dropbox, go onto your iPad, open Dropbox, download the file, open it in iBooks, and then check it and know there's a mistake and go through that all again. So we didn't really do a whole lot with that. But what that produced was that produced a what they call a reflowable EPUB. So that's the kind that has the resizable text and so on. And it didn't really occur to me straight away that teachers could use this to make stuff for their classes. And the first time that it kind of crossed my mind that this was a thing that you could do was I was working with a school in New York called Xaverian High School, and I spent a couple of days there, and then we took a trip over to Manhattan to a school called Marymount, which is right across the road from the Metropolitan Museum of Art on Fifth Avenue. So it's quite a fancy district, if you like. And we visited with some of the teachers there, and they were doing these incredible things. They had some iPads as well. And I remember I met with the English teacher, and she showed me this thing that she had made in Pages as an EPUB. And what it was she was teaching Shakespeare. And she said to me, look, the thing with Shakespeare is I want to teach these six sonnets, and four of them are in this book and two of them are in that book. And that means I've got to have two books. It drives me crazy. So what I did was, I being her, she took the four at one book, two at the other, and she put them all together in an EPUB, and she put that out for her kids. And it's like, wow, that's never occurred to me that you could do that. You know, teachers could make their own electronic books and resources for their kids. And their school wasn't a one-to-one iPad school. They had some iPads in the school, and a lot of kids had smartphones. And she said, look, this EPUB is so flexible that I can send it home to parents who've got different devices. Kids can put it on their iPod Touch. They can put it on their school iPad. It just goes anywhere. And it's got me reading the sonnet, and it's got the words of the sonnet in the book. And the kids could just play it back to themselves on their headphones while they're riding the subway into and out of school. So that was kind of my first encounter with teachers making their own resources for the classroom using these supposedly sort of commercial formats like EPUB and so on. So that was quite an eye-opener. I really enjoyed that idea. But still, it's fiddly. So I guess the big revelation in this was when Apple brought out iBooks Author, which is a free application. It only runs on the Mac, and we'll talk about that in a minute, I think. But the way I describe iBooks Author, because it's kind of intimidating to people with its name, right? iBooks, an author, right? Well, am I a book author? No, so that's not an app for me. But the way I've described it to people is that it's like Keynote for books or Keynote for text. I mean, do you remember what presentations were like before Keynote came out?
They were terrible.
They were terrible, yeah. A graduated blue background and jaggy yellow text, and sound effects on every bullet point. And what Keynote did for presentations, I think iBooks Author does for text, because what you can do with this is it looks very much like a cross between Keynote and Pages. You can drag in Pages documents, you can drag in Word documents, it'll try and make sense of them. And you have in the document a structure on the left-hand side and page layout on the right-hand side, and it's designed exactly for the 4:3 ratio iPad screen, and the layout is fixed in landscape in general. It does have a portrait view, and it tries to do some intelligent things when you rotate into portrait, but the default layout is landscape on the iPad. And I think iBooks Author has been a bit of a slow revelation for us at Cedars, because we found that, I guess the breakthrough in our thinking was that you don't have to be writing a book to use iBooks Author. And that was the kind of breakthrough in our thinking. Because we realized then that, well, if I want to just throw something together really quick with some pictures and a little video, do it in all on iBooks Author.
Yeah, you can make a study guide very quickly for students to take home for their midterms or final exams. You could add in a quick review quiz, some videos, some copies of the notes. Just very, you get kind of, I think you said it right, you can kind of throw it in there, and it looks pretty nice.
Yeah, a little bit of effort gets you something really nice, and a lot of effort gets you something outstanding. It's very much like Keynote in that kind of effort curve, if you like. I'll give you an example of something I did with iBooks Author just recently was this history of technology class that I've been talking about for a couple of weeks. the next thing that we're teaching is Vannevar Bush and the Memex machine. And he has this paper from 1945, an article that was published in The Atlantic called As We May Think, in which he speculates on such things as, in the paper he says, the camera hound of the future will wear an object on his forehead the size of a walnut. And then what I, and so on. And what I did with that article was I took it and I broke it. It's in 8 sections and I broke it up and I put it into 8 sections in an iBooks author book. Not really changing the text at all, but doing things like adding in glossary definitions for things like photocell and words that the kids might not know because the language is a bit old-fashioned. So, and what I did was I put that in my iTunes U course. But here was the what I thought was kind of the clever bit was there's a website which will let you create widgets for your iBooks author file. And widgets are interactive components that go inside a page. There are some built-in, gallery, quiz, movie, and so on. But you can make others. And a widget is basically a dashboard widget that you can make in Dash Code and you can install it in your book. There's a website that lets you make them. And one of the things it lets you do is this website lets you embed YouTube, streaming YouTube videos inside the book, which is beautiful because it means that the book doesn't contain the video. So the book's still 10 megabytes or whatever. But when you hit the image icon, it will start to stream the YouTube video right into the book, which I thought was really clever. So what I had in that section where Bush talks about the camera hound of the future wearing a thing the size of a walnut on his head, I linked to the stream of the Google Glass demo, where in fact people skydive over San Francisco wearing something not much larger than a walnut on the side of their head. And I thought that was quite a nice way to bring that concept directly to life.
Well, and again, I think that, you know, it was funny. I remember when that announcement was coming up and Apple was going to make an education announcement at their event. Everybody was hoping for Apple's answer to EPUB creation. And I think it's interesting. Apple said, we want something more. And I largely feel that way about electronic books because, yeah, we could just do basically PDF scans of our books. And yeah. And that, I guess, is better because that solves the backpack problem. But I'm looking for more interactive content like you're talking about where teachers can add in things to help further engage the student in the content. It's still the same curriculum. A student is still learning Spanish or they're still learning French or they're still learning about the Gettysburg Address. But anything mm-hmm. we can do to further engage them, that's what we want.
Yeah, I think so too, and I like what I was able to do with that, because that was almost like a throwaway idea. It wasn't like I wrote a textbook for my whole year. It was just, here's one lesson, here's a little thing you can have and you can go back to and look at again, and so on. But here's the clever part, I think, with what I did was I went through in iBooks and I took a screenshot of every page of the article, and then I took all of those screenshots and I took them section by section into Explain Everything. And what I did there was made a slideshow and explained everything of each page of the article. And I did a voiceover commentary on the article, highlighting the words I was talking about as we talked through the 2 to 3 to 4 pages that each section comprised. And then I had 8 videos. At the end of each section, I put the video in the book. So the book actually contained a commentary on the book in the book.
Well, you know, I just thought about something else. Obviously, this would be more of a high school. Let's say it's a high school history class. And I know like my world history class in high school, my 12th grade year, the teacher basically lectured every day and you took a handful of exams. He was trying to prepare us for what college history was like. And so imagine if you could record every one of those lectures. And at the end of the week, you could provide an iBooks author book with basically the audio files and then maybe a review quiz. And so over the weekend, you could listen to the lectures over again if you wanted to, and then take a review quiz, be ready and help you prepare for the exam. So again, it's just taking that content that you already have and you're already speaking, so just simply record it and then allowing students to re-listen. One of the things I'm actually doing right now is studying for my CWNA, which is my Certified Wireless Network Administrator exam. And I have some videos along with the book that I'm using to study with. Well, I actually converted those videos to audio as well because it's basically just somebody's PowerPoint slides or it looks like Keynote. and they're going over the material. So obviously it's great to look at as well. But when I'm at the gym, I've got those audio files now. And so they're talking about the concepts of the exam, and I can just continually listen to it. And so if you're able to provide a student with recaps of your lecture, if they miss something, they can just re-listen. If they're struggling with a concept, they can go over it and over it again. And again, think about how this affects if you have a student come down with the flu. You're able to give them the lectures they can listen to at home at their convenience.
Yeah. I think the iBooks author thing is very interesting because it works hand in hand with iTunes U. And I think you don't need either to use the other. So you can have an iTunes U infrastructure that you never touch iBooks author, and you can create plenty of iBooks author files you never touch iTunes U. But I find when both of these things work together, you've got a pretty powerful system, because one of the biggest problems before we adopted iTunes U this year, one of the biggest problems we had with using iBooks author was getting the files out to the students, because the files tend to be very large. You know, you're putting video in there, you're putting multiple images in there, you're putting text in there, and you're sort of, you mush it all up and turn it into a book. You can quite often and quite easily end up with a 300 to 500 megabyte file. And moving that wirelessly onto an iOS device is not easy at all. Safari doesn't handle it very well. Email's obviously too small. Dropbox, the Dropbox application on iOS can't always handle opening a file of that size. So we had some problems like that in the past. And
Evernote's 50 megs as well.
Evernote's 50 meg per note as well. But what we found was that iTunes U is the perfect way to distribute those large files, because iTunes U has the iTunes Store backend, and it's all designed so that downloading a very large file in the background is no problem. That's how that whole system is designed to work. It's the same infrastructure that delivers movies and books and apps to you. So what we can do is, if we do end up with a large iBooks author file for some reason, we can stick the book on iTunes U. Kids can download it to their iPad, works perfectly, and can handle files of any size. And that's those two have actually come together quite nicely for us.
Well, and along with the iBooks author discussion, we probably should mention that the iBooks store now sells textbooks for $15 in a lot of cases. Mm-hmm. And so I was talking with one of my vendors last week, again, unrelated to our textbooks, and I said, well, what we really want is a management system for ebooks. And he said, hey, what do you think about, I think he mentioned it was either Jamf or Casper, which other, those are mobile device management solutions. He said they can distribute ebooks. And I said, well, that's true. I said, and the iTunes store sells them, and you can buy them through the volume purchase program. But the problem with the licensing of the books that come from the iBook store is that they are licensed to the end user from then on. You don't get those back. And that kind of goes along with our previous discussion of it's, we can't afford to. So I can't afford to buy all these books every single year and the students basically keep them and really never want them again.
Yeah, this is exactly it. And in some ways, that textbook price cut that Apple announced in partnership with the publishers back in January, that was a crack in the wall, if you like. So they're saying, well, here's a $75 textbook that you can have for $15 and so on. Okay, you know, but schools have often kept their paper textbooks much longer than that multiple of a few years. So.
Well, and that's great. It seems like, and they're kind of starting at the college and high school level and working their way back. And again, I know I always see stuff from my, you know, K through fifth grade lens, but I don't know. It just doesn't work for us. That system of the students buying the books, that's just not our nature. We buy the books for the students. It's built into the tuition.
Yeah, and this is very much a kind of cultural thing. It's like a school culture question as well. You know, there are some schools where parents are perfectly used to buying. You know, the kid come home on day one with a book list and they go and buy every single one of them. And there are other schools and certainly some other countries where it's not just just not quite done that you might ask the parent to buy something, but it is actually a massive political problem if you ever ask a parent to contribute any money for anything relating to education. So it's more than just, well, this is how we do it. This is how we do it over here. In some cases, and I've seen this happen on occasion, it has blown up into massive admittedly local but massive political problem where schools have asked parents to contribute for X, Y, and Z?
Well, I think at this point, you know, we've kind of really, I guess, hammered on the problems. And I'm going to lay out my ideal situation. Like if I was given free reins to design anything for electronic books, like in terms of a management system, what I'd want. And it's really very simple. I want all of our books to be available from the iBook store. I want them to be available within the volume purchase program where I can buy 25 licenses of a math book for our fifth grade. And I want to be able to put those into Apple Configurator in largely the same way I do application. So where I can put them on an iPad and make the iPad supervised or unsupervised, where supervised means it cannot be used with any other iTunes library, or unsupervised where a student could then go home and so add their own content. But in done in such a way like apps where I can run those back through Configurator and get that license back so that I could then reuse it the following year. I want to do syncing of notes and your highlights over iCloud. Again, this is assuming that we have some sort of solution for our Apple ID problem. I want to do great integration with iTunes U, and I want interactive content. And so I don't feel like that we're asking for a whole lot, or I don't feel like I'm asking for a whole lot.
Yeah. It's just, in that list of things, I think the only thing you really don't have is that you don't have volume purchase for books and you can't put your books into Configurator.
Well, because go ahead. Well, I was going to say all of our books are we can't get them off from the iBook store. You know, it's like you'll have
there's that problem as well. Yeah.
You know, there was another school in town that we have a teacher that has students there, and it was a web based book, but it didn't work in Safari. It only worked in some browser called Puffer, which is obviously just a WebKit reskinned in the App Store.
Puffer's the one that can sort of pre-render Flash or something, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's just like you think, how in 2012 are we still having this problem where it's a web-based book and it doesn't work with Safari? It's mind-boggling.
Yeah. I mean, I've talked to you before, I think, about we subscribe to a curriculum system called Scholar in Scotland, and I wrote to them recently and asked, what are your plans for getting on Flash and Shockwave and Java? And they said, well, we can't really do that because 49% of the browsers that come to our site don't support HTML5.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's where we are, really. You know, and I mean, I agree with everything that you want there. I think those are pretty reasonable and certainly doable as well, because here's the thing, right? In our experience of deploying iBooks in our sort of limited and not totally compliant fashion, it was actually very easy, because if you buy your books from the iBook store, they follow the same DRM rules as apps. They behave in the same way. Our home sharing system recognizes new books and draws them across and so on. And there's not a different set of authorization rules for books as there are for apps, because they're both wrapped in the same DRM system. Apple's Fair Play DRM system. The apps, the books, the videos, they all have the same rules that are associated with them. And, you know, it doesn't seem to me a million miles away from the point where, well, if I can, you know, deploy one piece of Fair Play DRM content through Apple Configurator, surely I can deploy another one. And it's just a matter of time before that feature, I think, becomes something that we can do.
Well, and these kind of problems are frustrating because, just as I said with the television industry, it's not like you don't have the technology available, because that's frustrating, but at least you understand it. Well, you know, we can't distribute 300 meg files over email, because just email doesn't support that and probably won't ever. But it's just a matter of getting the people that control the content on board with us. And I think this is where I guess economics are against us, because just as there are only a few places you can get sports content from, you know, there's ESPN and then there's ESPN, there's only a few places you can get textbooks from. And it's not like you've got Kickstarter programs for history books.
Yeah, I mean, it's particularly a problem in places where the textbook content is decided at a very high level above the school. And putting iBooks author in the hands of individual teachers isn't going to crack that dam, because it's just such an insurmountable high-level political problem, particularly when politics are involved like they are in places like Texas and California. I think in Scotland, what I feel is that we may see a little more of this kind of thing because in Scotland, we don't have like a national textbook for a course. We have sort of de facto textbooks for some courses just because Scotland's not that big a place and there's not like 10 publishers want to publish a Scottish textbook. You know, there's maybe one or two because the purchasing pool is not that large even for courses that everybody takes. So you may have competition between two actors in the market and not 20, let's say. But I can see teachers starting to build up their own resources step by step to the point where they may have, there may even become freely available on the web. You know, here's a small textbook that just covers, I don't know, National 5 networking, you know, and that's all, and somebody else will put out something else and so on. And, you know, maybe that's the way it'll go.
I guess open source or crowdsource textbooks.
Yeah, but here's my reservation about iBooks Author, right? And I think it's a fantastic app. It's great that it's free. And what you can do with it is pretty powerful. But the reason I chased away the guys with the PDFs wrapped up as an app away from my door is really the same reason I have some reservation about iBooks Author, which is that for a long time, you know, schools have bought educational content from publishers and they've bought it as CD-ROMs, they've bought it as, you know, DVD-ROMs, they've bought it as applications that go on their PC and so on. And what I found in my sort of, I guess it's maybe 12 or 13 years now doing educational technology, that you buy some content wrapped up in code from a publisher and then the underlying system changes and then the publisher doesn't keep up. So what you end up with is you end up sort of emulating PowerPC Max for like 8 years after they've gone out of date because you've got this thing that you keep, you have to use for the curriculum and it only supports Mac OS 9, let's say. Right. Now that was the last world. The new world's I'm doing the same thing now, but it's Flash and Shockwave and Java.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm literally keeping computers around just to get access to some of this curriculum content. But that can't last forever, you know. That only lasts up until my next refresh. And then, you know, can I refresh two platforms just to... That content's not that valuable. We'd be better off taking that £25,000 and creating the content ourselves so we can move on.
Yeah, we've got that... I've got that looming problem in the spring because, as I mentioned before, we are still on Snow Leopard, which still has access to Rosetta. And a lot of our books have test generators, and they use their PowerPC-based applications. They look like they were written for Mac OS 9, to be truthful.
Mm-hmm.
But we will be upgrading to Mountain Lion in the spring with our new – we will probably have a mix of MacBook Airs and iPads. And I don't know what I'm going to do because I don't really – I mean, we can't even buy computers that have Rosetta on them anymore. They don't sell – Macs with Snow Leopard. There's no options for us there.
You can't buy a Mac that will run Snow Leopard either.
Right, and you can't emulate Snow Leopard in a VMware image because it's against Apple's terms. There was like one edition of VMware 4 that would do it, and then what's funny is I think that, for whatever reason, will not run on Mountain Lion.
Yeah, I think something that lion's been to the vet.
So, These are the areas that will drive you nuts in educational technology because you know what you want. You just can't buy it anywhere.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think the underlying point is that my caution, you know, people often sort of peg me as the guy who's obsessed with the iPad. And yes, okay, I am obsessed with the iPad, but I'm very cautious about content. And particularly content where you're going to spend a lot of money on it over a lot of years. You know, reading schemes, for example. I want that content to be as portable as possible. As great as iBooks Author is, it's not very portable. It's not even portable to iPhones. And this is a bit of an issue, right? Because when you build an iBooks Author textbook, it is specifically built for the iPad. Won't run on an iPhone, won't even run on an iPod Touch. And to me, that is a bit of a drawback, actually, to be honest. In fact, I think it's a huge drawback. But I would prefer, ideally, to have the content in some portable format, which I then access through a native application. Right? That's the way I want my life to be. I don't want to have HTML5 apps to create content on and then native content wrapped up as an app. I want it the other way around. I want my content to be portable and accessible, and I want my experience to be native. You know, so looking at an EPUB through iBooks is wonderful, you know, but looking at a PDF through an app is not what I want to do. And I don't want to spend money on that. So I'm trying to get more cautious over time about not getting locked into publishers, because basically at some level I just sort of don't trust them very much to keep up with the way the world's going. And the thing is, I don't want to get into this situation again where I've got to keep some old thing going just because we spent a lot of money on books a long time ago.
You've got to keep an original iPad around because your apps aren't compatible with iOS 6 or something like
that. Yeah, exactly, that kind of thing. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well,
That problem could come back and bite you again. That's not a solved problem just because you go to iOS. All right.
Well, good show. I guess in conclusion is we are frustrated.
That's pretty much been our conclusion for every show so far, is that we're a bit frustrated.
Well, these are great problems to have because we're so, and I think back to what I learned in school and what kind of technology we used. I mean, kids today, they have it so much better than we did, but I think we're kind of at this tipping point, I guess. I guess we'll look back in 10 years and think, wow, those jokers in their backpacks. I hope we do. Maybe not, but maybe this problem still isn't solved. Maybe we're still paying expensive cable prices and still carrying around backpacks. I don't know.
Yeah, who knows? I mean, I think one of the takeaways from this, I think, is to sort of stand back a little bit and look at the bigger picture and look at all the problems that we've solved.
That's true.
We have solved portability. We have solved the longevity of devices through the school day. We have solved the interaction problem. We have solved the file system problem. We have got to a point where the devices are so simple that anybody, literally anybody, I could teach anybody to use an iPad. And what we're complaining, the minutiae of what we're sort of complaining about here and discussing is, it's really the icing on the cake, you know. And I think one of the things about textbooks that kind of muddies the waters a little bit is if you look at most, I certainly looked at one or two surveys, I don't know about most, but I looked at one or two surveys about a year ago, which were, they were asking students and teachers and parents and school administrators what they thought would be the best use of a textbook in the or of a computer device in the classroom. And students and teachers all had very diverse views. It was go on the web, connect with other people, send email, read materials for reference and so on. But the school administrators and the parents all said textbooks. And then those bars were right up to the top because that was the thing that administrators and parents could think of that you could do with a tablet device in school. And I think, you know, I talk to people about this a lot. They ask me this question all the time. How do you have all your books electronic because you've got iPads? And the answer is no, we don't. And one of the reasons why we don't as well is because the iPad's in some ways too valuable in the classroom to lock it up as just a digital textbook. Because if you've got that textbook full on the screen and the kids aren't doing anything else on that device, okay, maybe they're flipping between certain applications, but I would rather have, and this is how I do it in my classroom, is I have a paper copy of a book that I also have electronically. And we use the paper copy in the class because the iPad is busy being a device for programming on or making notes on or something like that. And just thinking of that as an electronic book, I think is such a lack of imagination. That yes, it's one feature amongst many features that we want to get into the classroom.
That's true. 100% agree.
All right.
Well, I guess thanks everybody for listening. If you have any feedback, we have a feedback form at outofschool.net. We'll be back next week with another show. Again, thanks to DisplayNote at displaynote.com for sponsoring the show this week. We'll have a link to their website in the show notes. And I guess have a good week, everybody.